This week, we will be considering the reign of Amaziah, king of Judah. His reign overlapped with those of Jehoash of Israel, whom we discussed last week, and Jeroboam II, whom we will also consider this week. Amaziah was a king of half-hearted faithfulness, and his divided devotions would lead him to war with his northern neighbor of Israel, where the twin kingdoms of Israel and Judah had lived peacefully for a century prior. The two passages overlap, but 2 Chronicles 25 contains significant portions that 2 Kings 14 doesn't have, and vice versa. I recommend that you read both 2 Kings 14 and 2 Chronicles 25. If you have not done so yet, now would be an excellent time to pause and read them. Amaziah was the son of Joash, who had been the boy king of Judah. 15 years into Joash's reign, when he was 22, his son Amaziah was born to Jehoaddan, and 25 years later, in approximately 139 after the split, Amaziah became king of the southern kingdom of Judah, reigning for 29 years thereafter. Amaziah was generally faithful to Jehovah, but not entirely, somewhat like his father, but perhaps less extreme on both ends. He did not take away the high places. The passage opens with an example of Amaziah's good conduct. You may recall from a few weeks ago that Joash, Amaziah's father, had the prophet Zechariah, son of Jehoiada, murdered. That, obviously, was bad. In response, Joash's servants conspired together and killed him. The scriptures make no judgment on whether or not this homicide was justifiable, but they do tell us Amaziah's response. He had the assassins executed. Whether or not this was the correct response, the passage gives no judgment. However, the example of Amaziah's good and God-honoring behavior is found in that he restrained himself by not also killing the assassin's children. Obviously, in modern society, we would find it abhorrent to punish children for their parents' crimes, but we have the law of God to thank for that. Apart from Judeo-Christian morality, such penalties have been common in the history of the world. Here, owing directly to the influence of the law of Moses, see Deuteronomy 24:16, Amaziah restrained himself. After this, we turn our primary focus to 2 Chronicles 25, where the meat of the narrative lives. Here, Amaziah fights a war with Edom, which in turn stirs a war with Israel. Some 50 to 100 years prior, during the reign of Jehoshaphat, Edom had been a friendly vassal state to Judah, but 4 kings prior they had rebelled against Jehoram. In today's passage, Amaziah attempted to reestablish old dominance, and so he raised an army from Judah of 300,000 men. He also bolstered that by hiring from Israel 100,000 mercenaries. I find that number to be very interesting because only about 20 years prior, Israel struggled to raise an army one-tenth of that size, as we discussed last week, while considering Jehoahaz's reign in 2 Kings 13. While Israel's military had been decimated by Hazael of Aram in that generation, they must have fathered plenty of children before they died, because in the next generation their numbers rebounded amazingly. Perhaps Israel actually had more fighting men in Jehoahaz's generation than the passage reveals. Maybe for some reason Jehoahaz was not able to inspire his men to take up arms. But 100,000 men Israel sent to Amaziah for 100 talents of silver. That is, assuming we have correct conversions, which I don't think is certain, 75 pounds of silver per 1,000 men. This comes out to about 1 ounce of silver per soldier, a value in modern inflatable paper dollars of about $30 a man. That is a paltry sum. It is barely worthwhile to get out of bed to earn so little, much less to pack up your tent and weapons and supplies to ride off to the country next door for a war. These mercenaries were not riding out for this silver. They were riding out for the plunder. They wanted to pillage Edom and bring back some real spoils, women and treasures and livestock. The silver was more formality than payment. A prophet of Jehovah appeared before the king and shut down these plans. Jehovah, he said, was not with Israel, referenced by Ephraim, chief among their tribes. If Judah went to battle against Edom with the Israelites in tow, they would have 33% more men than without Israel, and yet they would lose, because God would be against them. We have no way to look at the alternate timeline to see whether this prophet was correct, but as we see here and elsewhere, these Israelites were a force to reckon with. Amaziah was willing to let the mercenaries go, but he expressed concern about recouping the $3 million worth of silver he had spent to hire them. That, of course, is a sunk cost fallacy. The money was spent. Keeping the soldiers and losing a battle would neither recoup the money nor make the expenditure worthwhile. In such a case of bad investment, it is better to cut the losses and move on. The prophet, however, pointed out that if Amaziah would be faithful in this, that Jehovah could give him much more. Amaziah would not be wholly faithful in this, and so he would not really see the value come to fruition. It would be a mixed bag. He did, at least, send the mercenaries back to Israel. Ominously and predictably, they were not at all happy about this. Here they had traveled out for war, only to get paid less than it cost them in fodder for their mules to carry them there, and then they were sent home. As for Amaziah, he attacked Edom, those being the people around Mount Seir. He killed 10,000 people in the Valley of Salt, that is the salty area around the Dead Sea, I presume, and captured another 10,000, whom he then killed with the gory spectacle of throwing them off of a cliff. In doing so, they captured a city called Selah and changed its name to Jokthiel. Meanwhile, when Amaziah's army was away, Israel's mercenaries were at play. They raided cities all the way from Samaria, their own capital, to Beth Horon. The reference to Beth Horon is a confusing one. Both Beth Horon and Samaria are in Israel's territory, not Judah's. So I'm not entirely sure what it means to say that they raided cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon. Whatever it means, they looted much spoil and killed 3,000 people, and that is a mess. Here the prophet had told Amaziah that bringing the Israelite mercenaries along would be trouble, but now we find that dismissing them was also trouble. The prophet was not wrong. Looking back to Jehoshaphat and everything that had happened since his time, we see that military alliances with Israel had been disaster after disaster for Judah. Here the prophet had predicted defeat by the Edomites if the mercenaries had been involved. I expect that this would have happened. So while Amaziah did not get a good outcome letting the mercenaries go, he did get a better outcome than he might have gotten. That said, it is hard to blame him for regretting that he had taken the prophet's advice. Of course, as we have noted, Amaziah was not wholly faithful to Jehovah, and so it is little surprise that Jehovah was not wholly faithful to him. We find an example of this in 2 Chronicles 25:14. Having defeated the Edomites, he stole their idols. This was a common military practice in the area at the time, a show of the utter defeat and humiliation of the people. The same prophet from before went back to Amaziah to denounce him for this, taking the idols, and he came with an argument against idolatry. He asked, paraphrasing, if these gods couldn't rescue the Edomites, then why should you pray to them? It isn't a bad question, but it isn't really logically foolproof either. There have been many times when Jehovah has allowed his people to lose battles for a variety of reasons, both known and unknown, but this does not reflect on the validity of worshiping him. Regardless, the idols of Edom represented false gods, and worshiping them was a violation of the first and second commandments. When the prophet made his pronouncement, the king was displeased. He told the prophet, essentially, that he was out of order. He was not an appointed counselor to the king. No one wanted his advice, and if he kept giving it, he would be killed. I will reiterate, as I have many times before, that the scriptures do not justify the use of force against people for their speech, with the exception of cursing God or advocating idolatrous worship. The prophet had every right to speak against the king. As a prophet, he was delivering a message from God which he had a duty to deliver. King Amaziah was obligated to tolerate this. Threatening to kill the prophet for this was very wrong. You can imagine that, as one who is currently imprisoned on accusations that I denounced government workers, this positive example of God sending a prophet to do just that is particularly important to me. Because Amaziah had not listened to the prophet, he concluded his remarks with a curse. God had determined to destroy Amaziah because he had worshipped idols and would not listen to correction. Indeed, our response to offensive speech should be that we listen to it. Maybe what the speaker says is right, and we should apply his words. Or maybe what the speaker says is wrong, and we should offer him correction. In either case, we should have the humility to, at least, listen. The correct response to speech is more speech, not violence and not silencing people. The wrath of God would fall on Amaziah in the form of war with Israel. There had been peace between Israel and Judah for about a century prior, but this incident with the mercenaries had inflamed international tensions. Had Amaziah not fallen into idolatry, he might have come up with a peaceful solution, or God might have given him victory over Israel. Instead, Amaziah picked a fight and brought disaster on himself. He sent messengers to Jehoash of Israel calling him to battle. Again, I'm going to express my amazement that Israel was prepared to put up a winning army. A generation prior, they had only 10,000 soldiers. But in Jehoash's time, they were able to send 100,000 mercenaries to join Judah. In that same generation, Israel defeated the Arameans, see last week's message on 2 Kings 13, and here they are now about to confidently whip Judah, which just brought 300,000 veteran soldiers back from victory over Edom. It is truly a shocking turn of events. In response to Amaziah's challenge, Joash sent back a sort of mocking parable or proverb. He said that the thistle, an insignificant plant, asked the cedar, a mighty tree, to give him the cedar's daughter to marry the thistle's son. This is an obvious mismatch. The great do not give the lowly their beloved daughters. By analogy, the great king of Israel would not belittle himself by answering an insignificant foe like Judah. It is quite an insult to say that someone is so small that he is not even worth fighting. Back to the parable. It ends with a beast of Lebanon trampling the thistle. The point? Judah thought they were tough stuff beating the Edomites, but if they showed up in Israel, Jehoash would easily crush them. Well, God had planned to destroy Judah, so Amaziah would not listen. He insisted on fighting, and so, before Amaziah could even march his army into Israel, Jehoash's army marched down to Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh is in Judah's territory, ironically near to the border of Edom, south of the Dead Sea. And at Beth Shemesh, Israel gave Judah a butt-whooping. Amaziah was captured, and Jehoash tore down a significant section of Jerusalem's wall, which would prohibit them from being a military threat until it could be rebuilt. He also took hostages and all the gold and silver in the king's treasury. Sometime thereafter, Jehoash died, and his son, Jeroboam II, took over as king of Israel. Amaziah of Judah reigned for 15 more years thereafter, until about 168 after the split. The people of Judah were no more happy about the fact that he had abandoned the worship of Jehovah than they were that his father had, and so, like his father, he suffered assassination. The conspiracy started in Jerusalem. Amaziah fled to Lachish, a town in Judah's southwestern wilderness, to escape, and then they just killed him there instead. Our author cites his source and mentions that Amaziah's son Uzziah, alternately called Azariah, reigned in his place. Meanwhile, Jeroboam II was king in Israel. The simple fact that he was named Jeroboam doesn't bode well for him. Throughout his book, the name Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Israel's first king after the split, is synonymous with evil and idolatry. Jeroboam I, you will recall, is the one who set up the golden calf idols. Jeroboam's father, I suppose, wanted his son associated with that. Now, this Jeroboam II was the son of Jehoash, son of Jehoaz, son of Jehu. That makes him the third generation after Jehu in Israel. You will recall that Jehu's dynasty was prophesied to last to the fourth generation. So look for Jehu's dynasty to end with Jeroboam II's son, Zechariah, in a few weeks when we study 2 Kings 15. Despite the fact that Jeroboam II was an evil king, he reigned 41 years, from about 153 to 194 after the split. It was during his reign that Jonah, son of Amittai, came on the scene. Jonah was a prophet, best known for the book bearing his name. He's the one who would be swallowed by the great fish. We'll plan to start his book next week. In today's passage, though, Jonah performs a ministry of a less extraordinary sort. He came from Gath-Hepher in Zebulun's territory, and he brought a message of hope to Israel. This is somewhat surprising. By this point in the narrative, Israel had not been faithfully serving Jehovah for over a century. But God was still a deliverer to them. Jonah gave them the message that Jehovah had seen their bitter affliction and would deliver them. The exact nature of the affliction is not perfectly clear. We know that going all the way back to Ahab, Israel had experienced continual problems with the Arameans. Most recently, in 2 Kings 13, we read of how the Arameans oppressed Israel under King Jehoahaz, but in that generation they experienced some deliverance. Jehoash then pushed Aram back further with victories that had been prophesied by Elisha, but exactly what territory Jehoash took back is unclear. Here we get some clarity. Under Jeroboam II, Israel took back everything, from the Sea of the Arabah, that is the Dead Sea, the southernmost point of the East Jordan area, all the way to Hamath, an Aramean city northeast of the Aramean capital of Damascus. It's so far out there that it doesn't even appear on our online interactive map. So the Arameans were not just pushed out of Israel's territory in the Transjordan, but Israel finally turned the tables and pushed deep into Aram's territory. I find this all to be perplexing. Clearly God blessed Jeroboam II's reign. He reigned 41 years, longer than any other king of Israel or Judah except for Asa of Judah, with whom he ties. Even David and Solomon had shorter reigns. And under Jeroboam II, Israel had greater military successes than they had experienced since the split. And yet, Jeroboam was a wicked king. This, the passage tells us, is because Jehovah had decided not to blot them out from under heaven. But then this is also perplexing, because in this very generation, Jonah's ministry would be planting the seeds of Israel's downfall. Jonah would prophesy to the Assyrians, and within 10 years, the Assyrians would be making serious military trouble for Israel. Within 50 years, Israel would fall completely and go into exile in Assyria. So this, I think, represents the last hope for the northern kingdom. Jehovah has given them all the help they're going to get. At this point in the narrative, they have their kingdom back, and they have an opportunity to follow Jehovah freely and enjoy his blessings. Unfortunately, they won't take it. So Jeroboam II died, and his acts were recorded, and his son took his place. To conclude then, 2 Kings 14 and 2 Chronicles 25 tell us the stories of two overlapping kings, Amaziah in the south and Jeroboam in the north. Amaziah was morally conflicted. He showed restraint in sparing the children of his father's assassins, and he obeyed the prophet by releasing the Israelite mercenaries. But he also worshipped the gods of Edom. God gave him victory over Edom, but then defeat before Israel. A few years later, Jeroboam II took the throne of Israel, and with prophetic assurance from Jonah, he swept to victory over Aram. Next week, we'll hear more about Jonah as we study his book. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.